right, folks, we are back on the flagship.com T-Top podcast, and this episode is brought to you by TaylorMade and all new SimMax and SimMax OS irons. Stefan Tudor Pearson, my co-host Scott Cloud. How are you doing today, Scotty?
I am warm. It is warm here in Ontario, and you know what? I guess that means it's golf season too, right?
Yeah, I walked three measly holes last night and was full on. Well, I mean, I don't even know if
you sound enthusiastic.
Yeah, it wasn't great. Probably why I only walked three. But I was just full on sweat after I think one. It was just it's just so hot.
Yeah, it's that time in Canada where we, you know, we don't want to complain, because in the wintertime, you know, when we're sitting there with all sorts of snow, we're going, I'd give anything for it to be hot. But yeah, when it's, you know, hovering close to 40 Celsius with the Humidex and you're trying to even concentrate on your golf game, it's pretty hard to do it.
Yeah, and then throwing bugs and who knows what else. We need a storm real bad, but I think we've lost all of our listeners at this point. But speaking of hot, Webb Simpson, this guy is hot this year, picked up his second win at Harbour Town at the RBC Heritage. And it's weird. Like, we're just going to talk about this like it's normal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we just went 3 months of making up topics on this podcast and finding something to talk about. And now we're 2 weeks in, and everything just kind of feels normal in the world of golf. And Webb Simpson winning and everybody hating him for winning is normal.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems that way. I mean, short of, you know, no spectators out there, which we'll get into in a little bit. But yeah, we're right back on the horse, you know, watching golf on a Sunday afternoon and seeing the best players in the world out there. And yeah, it seems somewhat normal. I mean, there was a few incidents and a few different things that happened during the week, Nick Watney being one of those cases, and we'll get to that. But, you know, seeing Webb back out there winning, I guess that is the normalcy right there. That's the normalcy, you know, sort of barometer.
Yeah, this guy's on fire this year. He's currently first in birdie average, first in scoring average, top 10 putts per round, first in putts within 6 feet, first in round three and four scoring, which I believe, like, if you kind of get what I'm getting at
the anti-Rory.
Yeah, but what I'm getting at here is you didn't hear me say anything about him being well at driving or even putts. Yeah. It's not that great. He's 100th in driving this year if we look at all the stats combined. And then his putting, you know, as I said, putts per round and 6 feet are good. But other than that, he's, you know, nothing special. He's just getting it done. And I think that's the key here is, you know, if you look out at every single one of his stats, you're not going to see much in the top 25 except the ones that actually matter. And that's scoring birdies and you know, the days that you need to score, Saturday and Sunday, moving day and closing day. It's just impressive to watch. The seventh win of his career. He also has that one major in there for the U.S. Open, which feels like yesterday to me, even though when was it? That was like 8 years ago now, or seven years ago now. Like, crazy to think.
Yeah, 2012, I think that was. But, you know, you're right. He gets things done in the areas that he needs to. And I think there's a lesson there for a lot of golfers. And, yeah, we saw a lot of people sort of hating on Webb for a little bit for maybe, you know, they call his game boring or something like that. Well, you know what? Just because he's not hitting it, you know, 3,000 yards doesn't mean much, really. I mean, in the end, this is a scoring game. It's about who has the lowest score. And I think if the average listener out there realized that, maybe they'd spend a little bit more time on the scoring end of their games rather than just trying to squeeze out three more yards off the tee.
Yeah, and I think there's guys that out there that hit it the exact same length as Webb, but they lash at the ball and they throw everything into the ball and just so they can, it looks like they're trying that much harder. And I think people would rather watch them, but if you actually look at their stats, they're probably the exact same. Webb just hits fairies and greens, and I think everyone just doesn't like the little hitch at the after in his follow through, which is, like I said on Twitter, seconds, milliseconds, but you know, after he makes contact. Up until that, everything looks great to me. I don't have a problem with his swing. And yeah, maybe he shanks it a few times every once in a while. Who doesn't? I found a couple this week. It happens to the best of us, Webb. But this guy is just an absolute ATM. He only has kind of a one stretch in his career where he didn't have a win, and it was the 3 years from 2015 to 2017. And in that stretch, he still made $6 million. It's like an average $2 million a year, which is just impressive. No matter what, he's still just an absolute ATM out there. And, you know, he said that was, you know, not just, wasn't putting well over those last couple of years. And now look at him. Here he is, two wins this year, leads the FedEx Cup, getting it done. And, you know, it's hard not to pick him if he keeps it up. He's just been playing really well over even what we look at last year, too. Just really, really well. He'll probably be on, you know, unfortunately not the Ryder Cup team, which we'll get into. He won't be on it this year, maybe next year. But, you know, who knows? Why can't he be in contention in majors this year?
Yeah, totally. And I think a lot of people don't figure that, you know, they don't think about it. This is not figure skating. It's not about aesthetics. It's about scoring and getting things done. And he's doing that. You know, he had that weak 3-year period. That was when he's making his adjustment from the anchored putting to the method that he uses now. And, you know, obviously all the other parts of his game, whether it's from his mental game or, you know, just his ability to grind it and be resilient is really important. And I think people have to realize that this guy is a super talented guy. He always has been. And obviously if you've won a US Open, you are pretty talented. What are the heights of that? Who knows? I mean, there might be some golf courses where he can't compete, but I think that's the case for a lot of the players that are out there. There are certainly some layouts, and in this case, Harbortown, you know, it's perfectly suited to what he does. You know, he might not be able to compete on every golf course, but you know what? If you can get the golf ball in the hole, I think that will at least get you a good placing at just about anywhere that you play the game.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Harbortown way more than the week before at Colonial. I think this is just a more fun golf course to watch these guys shape shots in good ways. I think Colonial, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, you saw it with Bryson. He was just bombing everything over. You really couldn't do that here. And Bryson absolutely exploded physically, but also on Sunday, just hitting it, you know, into people's heads. Did you see, I don't know if you saw, at one point he was literally claiming his ball was stuck in a tree.
No, I missed that.
Yeah,
actually.
So he's standing below it, and he's like, it's up there. I know it's up there. He had hit a provisional, and it's like, it's not up there. You hit it, like, into somebody's window, and you're just saving face. Like, it's such a rare thing for it to happen, but I don't want to get too much into Bryson. It's clearly working. This guy's hitting bombs. I saw someone, a TrackMan today, of 360 carry, where they're at the Travelers this week on the TrackMan. Like, just insane numbers. And we don't need to get into that right now, because let's go the opposite way with Abraham Answer, who is, like, one quarter the size of Bryson. This guy is so tiny. I don't think people realize how tiny he is. He's listed at 5'7". That might be generous. I can tell you his weight listing at 160 is extremely generous. This guy's got an elite short game, but that's not even what was on display this week. 65 of 72 greens, which I was like, okay, maybe that's just what he does. No, he's like 52nd in this year in greens and regulations. So like, I wonder, what were you seeing in his game that just propelled him up to this? Cause I don't think anyone was really expecting this week.
Yeah. I mean, he just had a lot of confidence. You could see it in his game. And not only is it, you know, 65 of 72 greens, this is 65 of the greens at Harbortown, which are one of the smallest on tour. And you know, you joke about, you know, the size of them. I was having a laugh when he was in doing his press conference. And if you look at him behind the microphone, you almost had to duck your head sideways to see him behind the microphone, because the microphone's almost bigger than he is. No kidding. But you know what? You just really confident in his game. Timing was really good. You could just see he didn't hesitate over any shot that they showed. He certainly was feeling it. And any of the shots that he probably missed, you know, if you go back and look them, it wouldn't have been by much. And, you know, Michael Gligic talked about it on the show. You know, he talked about Abraham Answer as being the guy he looks to watch his short game. Well, he didn't even have to use his short game much this week. And, you know, caddy Dale Vallaly, the Canadian, helped him out pretty good there, too. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him compete this week up in Connecticut.
Yeah, I think there was more talk on Twitter about Dale smoking darts out there. Yeah. Every time he was on the screen, he had a cigarette in his mouth, which is rare because it's usually a piece of bacon. But we've been begging for Dale on this podcast, so if he hears this, he's welcome on any time. But just speaking of that short game, I was watching, and if you're not following Dale Filelli on Instagram. You should, just for when he plays practice rounds with Abraham. He was doing these shots, and it's like they're about like 30 yards away from the green where you don't have a lot of running. And he's basically way off his back foot, but he's opening his club face like a massive flop shot. And then just like falling through with as much speed as possible. And what it ends up is just being this kind of high shot that just literally stops on a dime like you're doing that kind of low spinner. And I was practicing it. It's such a hard shot to be consistent. And it's probably so rare that you actually would need something like this, especially off the fairway. But it's just like, how does he even envision this? I would never even think to grab my 58 from 30 yards and off my back foot, wide open stance, and like slap. Oh, it's such a cool shot.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find something for you, and maybe you can post it on the Twitter account and get people to try to recreate it. Because just make sure there's no cars in the parking lot nearby you, because you'll blight a few. But just an elite short game, number one in the world this year of putts inside 3 feet, has yet to miss one. Weird stat though, at 4 feet, he's 133rd. And it's just crazy how that makes any sense, but I digress. I think the big story coming, we thought was going to come out of the weekend, though, was that Nick Watney positive test for COVID-19. So obviously we're thinking about Nick, but Nick didn't play the week before, came in obviously on his own, test positive, and it's kind of how the tour handles it now. I think where what we'll hear and what will be the story to follow is like, do we see more this week after that? Who was actually around him? He did play Thursday. He would have been there Tuesday, Wednesday. When did this happen? This is the thing that they've kind of planned for. Mm-hmm. So, what were your first thoughts when you heard about it?
Well, I wasn't too surprised. And, he had to look into the circumstances of, kind of tracing it and where he was at. Obviously, he went home. His wife runs a pediatric practice. So who knows, from a medical side of it, there could be some, some issues there as far as some connectivity with people that way. I wasn't too surprised by it. It was kind of odd, the fact that he did, take the test and they let him go out and practice, while that was pending, even though he hadn't felt well. So that was kind of surprising that way. They're reporting today, and we're probably going to hear about it by the time this podcast comes out. Jordan Spieth has actually been talking just at his press conference today. This is on the Tuesday, that the tour will make some adjustments to the health and safety protocols in the wake of that test. So it sounds like they're going to do some extra testing, some mandatory tests for anyone within 6 feet of someone who's tested positive. And so we're going to see some of those changes. So, it was bound to happen that we're going to see some adjustments. It's unfortunate the case that it did happen as far as Nick Watney. It might not be the last, unfortunately, and that's the reality of it, but it certainly gives you pause about professional sports and makes you wonder, what's the situation going to be like going forward as far as some of these events. And it doesn't make me too surprised then when you start to see more events considering not having spectators.
Yeah, I agree, and we'll probably get into that shortly. I think my biggest concern when I heard about this is originally there was kind of the whispers of this has happened. So, I'm sure you did the same thing. Like, who do we know on the grounds? Who can we chat with? I messaged a couple of people and they all kind of said the same thing. Like, I actually saw him on the range. I doubt it. Like, it could be anything. It's like, and then you find out and then you look back at that line. I saw him on the range that day. What are you doing on the range? Like, I understand, Nick, like, what are you doing? Think about it. Like, just take the precaution. And I get it. You're in the middle of a golf tournament. But B, the fact that tour even let him on the range, knowing he said he didn't feel well, knowing he said he had the symptoms, knowing they did the test, and they still went to the range before they pulled him out of the like, it's just, I think they think this bubble is legit. And I think it's more like everyone's standing inside of a hula hoop, really, right? Yeah, like, there's nothing really protecting them. Like, yeah, you're all tight and enclosed, but, that the hula hoop can only do so much, and it's not much.
No, it's not a big, you know, it's not a big lead shield around everyone. I mean, to try and think of it that way, I think is just, you know, assuming too much safety. So, you know, I think players, caddies, everybody that's involved with the tour is just going to be that much more careful. It's definitely precautionary, and players have talked about that already. And the fact that number of them that were there had said, you know, maybe I need to pay attention to this just a little bit more, and maybe it'll make people a little bit more cautionary. But certainly, you know, as we go forward, when we start to look at events like Memorial, for an example, that, you know, are looking to host, you know, 8,000 spectators in there, it makes you start to wonder, you know, what adjustments might be made, and will the PGA Tour retract on that as they, you know, some of the majors, and one of the majors announced already, the PGA Championship, is that they will have no spectators this year.
Yeah, which I think is a smart thing. And I mean, we'll get into the topic of, like, do we actually think this changes much for us? Which was one of our mailbag questions that we're going to move up earlier in this episode. Yeah, the PGA Championship, no spectators. To be honest with you, I kind of expected it. I think the US Open will do the same thing. I think the Masters will end up doing the same thing. They'll all, I believe they all should do the same thing, right? Like, we don't, the numbers in the States, and, you know, luckily in Canada, we're in a good place right now, or at least a better place. But, you know, the pandemic is still real. It's still happening. There's still a disease that could kill you out there right now. And I think, just what's the benefit of having spectators at the Memorial? What's the benefit of having the PGA? Because I've watched the last 2 weeks, and it felt fine to me. The only difference, the only weird thing ever that ever feels weird is 18. I just like right at the end, it's just weird. It's like,
yeah, I mean, you know, just because you don't have the thunderous applause, you know, that's fine. I mean, but when you think about it, most of the people that are watching the tournament are home anyways. They're not there watching. So, you know, the live experience, as much as it is neat in a way, golf is a little bit different than other major sports. Major sports, you're there, you know, you're able to see everything that's going on. In golf, you're only watching the group that you're watching. So it's nice for the spectator, or for the players, to maybe have some spectators there clapping, and maybe, you know, finding a loose ball every now and then. Maybe they'll find, you know, Bryson's ball up the tree, but maybe that's what he was upset about. But in the end, really, I mean, you know, if you're a spectator, a golf fan, the majority of the golf fans who are watching on TV, I don't think it makes that much of a difference. It might have some positives for you, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it, for a lot of guys, I don't think it makes a difference too. I think a lot of them, you know, people think full fans follow everyone around. Many times you're out there and you might have four people following you around, and they might be related to you. Like, for example, when Chapel shot 59 at Greenbrier, we had one fan following around his front nine. It was his wife. And then she left. Think about that for a second. This guy was en route to 59 and she left. Yeah. And then, you know, the cameras showed up, and then maybe, I'm not joking, we may have had 10 people following, which also might, you know, might be why the tournament doesn't exist anymore. But, like, I think that's more common than people think out there. So I actually don't think it affects. It doesn't affect my watching. I don't really care. I think it's actually made watching better. I think, you know, the microphones, you're hearing more. Shout out to Dottie Pepper. Is she not the best in the business of just, like, knowing when to, you know, stop talking, let them talk, and interjecting when it makes sense? Just so good. Which is the opposite of Nick Faldo, who's just, this guy's, is he done? Cause, like, you know,
oh man,
some guy hits a shot and all you guys, brilliant. It's like,
yeah,
great. Why are you there? Why are you making $2 million a year, whatever you make from NBC, CBS, whoever you work for? It doesn't matter. It's just like, I don't get where the commentary's at. And kind of, and Brooks, you know, called them out on Twitter a little bit, which I thought was amazing. I said a few weeks ago, I've officially bought my membership to the Brooks Koepka fan club.
That's quite a turnaround.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's this is just adding. I might go up to the gold membership.
Yeah, you might. You know, I think, you know, Koepka's got a point. There's a lot of microphones that are out there already. I think the problem with Faldo in this case is that, you know, Faldo's not really separating his ego as a player and an announcer, and he has to understand that he's not the show. The players are the show. they're the ones that are important here. These are the ones, these are the people we want to hear from, the players and the caddies. Anybody that's there, whether they're an analyst, play-by-play, you know, whatever the case may be, they should be just complimenting what's going on, the action that's going on. So for somebody like Nick Faldo to think that, you know, he's the show and, you know, he better realize it pretty quickly that, you know, we respect him for his playing ability and obviously winning six majors, but that doesn't mean that, you know, he's got the right to kind of make everything be about him and what he says.
Yeah, I love the fascinating stuff was his line this week.
Oh, crazy.
Like, great. Yeah. Great. I'm glad you played all that golf for that rather than give us actual insight. But yeah, I actually think it's getting better. You know, there was that interaction with Adam Hadwin, I believe on the Thursday, maybe it was the week prior, I forgot, where he picked up the, he thought was a piece of sand. No, it was this week. He thought it was a piece of sand, rock, but it actually was a piece of sand, and like he was all mic'd up. You wouldn't have heard that if he wasn't mic'd up, which was really cool experience. And, you know, he handled it really well, but also probably why a lot of guys don't want to do it is because they wouldn't handle it that well. Like, you know, imagine a John Rahm in that situation. It's not going to go over that well, and you're probably not even going to get that audio. I think I do agree that the announcers should kind of keep quiet and listen when it makes sense. But when you're going to speak, at least have something to say other than fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I mean, their job is really to add insight more than anything. And I think the conversations that we're seeing between the players and the caddies, it's much like the change in like NASCAR, for an example, where they put the microphones in the cars and you could hear the conversations between the pit crews and the drivers. That made a lot of things, you know, more relatable as far as what's going on and made it more fascinating for a sport. You don't necessarily have to hear the commentators. Yes, they have to be experts and they have to be able to dive in when they need to add support and add texture to the story of what's playing out. But in the end, the story is the players, it is the golfers, it is the tournament. It shouldn't be the announcers, shouldn't be the media, shouldn't be anything else. So again, they should be just there to support it. And the more of those conversations, more of those, you know, mic'd up things that we hear with, you know, Hadwin, for an example, the player interactions back and forth, that's just going to make it more compelling for the audience, not only now, but to keep an audience going into the future.
I agree. I think from a fan standpoint too, we got to realize Adam Hadwin had, I was listening to this interview and he basically said like in between us hitting shots, it's pretty boring.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot they're talking about. Like it's pretty rare that you're actually talking about golf in between a shot, unless it's like down the stretch, which I thought they did a great job when Webb was coming down 18. There was nothing. It was just him and his caddy talking about, they were talking about actually preparing for next year. Like, I need a number to this landing because it plays a big difference with the rollout because he flubbed that 3-wood. He almost got under it. He popped it straight up in the air and it hit that rollout and rolled out quite a bit. So now, you know, his caddy's probably thinking, okay, you know, if 260 is here and now it's actually rolling it out to 285. Well, that's actually one less club we can always hit off this tee versus, and he probably never thought about that, right? That's cool stuff that I would never have picked up on. But in between usually shots, it's a lot of like, hey, what'd you eat last night? What are you getting up to tonight? Yeah. Hey, are you heading out right after the, you know, pretty basic stuff, or, you know, or who you betting on tonight in the, you know, the ASU versus Arizona game, something like that. So I think fans are imagining it to be a lot more interesting than it is, but it's better than nothing and better than what Faldo's been bringing to the table for the last couple of weeks.
It certainly seems that way.
You called it last week about this King and the Bear Challenge or whatever it was called, the King of the Bear Classic.
The King and the Bear Massacre?
Yeah. Chris Kirk, amazing story.
Yeah, a really cool story here.
Which we'll get Kirk, but he shot minus 26 to win the King and the Bear Classic, where minus 25 obviously got you into second place. Can you imagine shooting minus 25, going 65, 65, 67, 66, and in losing the tournament? Or can you imagine shooting minus 21, coming in sixth place at minus 21, coming in sixth place and only making 20 grand? Like, just crazy stuff of what's happening out there. You've been there. You kind of touched on it. Why don't you touch on it again? Why this course was such a pitch and putt?
Yeah, it's just a resort course. It's wide open. Fairways are wide. Greens are fairly flat. There's not a lot of challenge that's there. I know the tour obviously was, you know, trying to accommodate an extra event, and they're trying to do, you know, have it in that area because obviously they had the tournament the week before, the Dyes Valley course in nearby Jacksonville in Ponte Vedra. Sorry. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it is a resort course. So it's designed for people to come, go to the World Golf Village, you know, hit and giggle and play it around there. So those players are so skilled, they're going to take it apart. But having Chris Kirk do it, you know, considering, you know, his story, having the fact that he, you know, he took 6 months off and he worked through his alcohol abuse and depression that resulted from that. And, you know, he hadn't won a tournament since 2015. And you know, we look for those storybook, you know, tales, and this was definitely one. And certainly it was good to see him win. And you know, it's another step for him to get back to the PGA Tour as well.
Yeah, he came from behind. He was the first alternate this last week at the RBC and decided to go play the Korn Ferry Tour event. Good idea. You know, picks up a win, picks up a nice check of, I don't know, $108,000 or something like that, which is good for a guy that, you know, took a lot of time off and dealt with his issues. And, you know, we're proud of him for doing that. What a great golf swing he has. He's always had that long flowing, you know, Ernie Els like swing that us short guys can't have because we just can't create the length doing that. But I just love watching his golf swing, and I just love where his head's at. He had a great interview afterwards. Like, yeah, he won. He has a deeper appreciation, but it's Father's Day and, you know, tomorrow, I guess, because they ended on Saturday. Yep. And he just couldn't wait to get home, and that's the important stuff. And I think we've talked about this a lot, and I was talking about it with a fellow pro just about, you know, golf can be a lonely game, right? And you know, he wasn't making excuses. He talked about that, like, you know, but maybe I'm not built for life on the road 30 weeks of the year. And then you're walking out there alone most of the time, and the only person out there rooting for you is your caddy, right? And like, yeah, it's odd. And now you're at a Korn Ferry Tour event with no fans, no family. And now even more, the only person out there rooting for you is your caddy. And, you know, it's just nice to see that great story for clearly a good guy. And, you know, if that means he's out on the PGA Tour and get to watch that swing week in and week out every week, that'll make me extremely happy.
Yeah, I think the big thing here is it just really raises the bar on the fact that you know, we realize these people are human. You know, they're not just athletes. You know, these are not, every guy is jumping in a jet, private jet, and zipping around the country. I mean, they're not all the tour superstars that are out there. There's a lot of people that are making their living in the game without being on that, you know, on that level. And the fact that, you know, he addressed his issues that he had, was very public about it. And, you know, I think that's therapeutic and helpful for a lot of other people, because there could be somebody else that's struggling in those situations. And because of his bravery, and he's willing to do this in public, which, you know, he certainly could have, you know, kept this all to himself.
But many others that have, right?
Yeah. So the fact is that he's doing it in public, you know, will definitely probably have an impact on a lot more people than just his own family. And like you said, the, you know, having his wife and his three boys and getting home to them for a hug on the Sunday was probably that much more meaningful for him.
For sure. Do you want to get into this story about the Ryder Cup, or are we just not sure yet or willing to chat about it? Because, you know, I don't want to say all reports, but it's certainly starting to speculate that the Ryder Cup will not be played this year, which, when was the last time they actually had to cancel it? I have no idea. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, it would have been 2001 when the of change course, went. Yeah. Yeah, it was made there. So, you know, it's not without precedent as far as the Ryder Cup being moved. Basically, there's just a lot of reports right now. PGA of America won't confirm it yet. Obviously, they were dealing with, you know, what was going to happen about the PGA Championship first, considering this event is later in the year. But it's certainly looking more and more like it could be delayed. And a number of players have come forward on both sides and expressed their, you know, their opinion that the Ryder Cup should be pushed back to 2021. And, you know, at this point, you know, if there's this much discussion about it, maybe it's really a distraction, and really maybe it's just as well that they do that, and you know, then they don't have to worry about it, and we can all be talking about it again in 2021.
I agree. I wasn't on this page for a while, but the reason I agree now is just because the European Tour has been playing, and a lot of times you get that guy that comes from the European Tour that, you know, you don't see often at PGA Tour events. And he just had an amazing at the on the European Tour. He's out there and just makes a huge impact. And if they're not playing, we don't know when they're playing. Who knows how that looks, right? And mm-hmm. you know, you have a lot of guys. You know, we talked about like Lee Westwood, and he mentioned this, for example, like for them to even get over here is, you know, you got to come over and you got to sit out for a week or two and do all that type of stuff. Like, it's, I think it just might make more sense to push it back a year. I think it's a good idea to have a break. Who knows what could happen? Maybe, who knows? Maybe something happens in the next month or so that's a drastic change, but, you know, that would need a miracle for something like that to happen. But I think it makes sense. I've started to come around on the idea that the Ryder Cup needs fans, which I was against when it was like, let's force fans into it now. But if it's like, we will push it back a year, sorry, President's Cup. Also, think about that power. Be like, sorry, yeah. President's Cup. We're a little busy this year. Like, push it back a year. Do it then where fans can come and do it right. Get the right players involved that, you know, they have the opportunities to earn their spots on the team. I think it's the best idea. We'll see what actually happens, though.
Yeah, if they just push both events, which is what would happen, they would push the President's Cup back into another year cycle as well. I don't think there's any harm in it, really, in the end. I mean, think about it. We're scheduled as it is to have six majors, I think, in the next 6 months as it is. So missing out on the Ryder Cup is probably not going to hurt too much.
Nope. But there's still golf happening all over the world, and we actually have had a couple tours start up in our area, but there's been a tour that's been happening in Vancouver for a long time now, and we actually have the commissioner of that tour on this podcast. Why don't you give us a quick rundown of the gentleman joining us today, Scotty, and what do you think we're going to chat with him about?
Yeah, the commish, Fraser Mulholland, who's the founder, president, and commissioner of the Vancouver Golf Tour, is going to join us today. And, you know, he's a PGA member, was a fine player in his own right, and really just wanted to bring him on for a couple of reasons. One, to, you know, tell us a little bit more about the tour, talk a little bit about the fact that some of the very prominent players have played on that tour and are still playing on that tour. And then also as well, he was one of the first tours in Canada, if not the first to get back playing this year. So I would love to explore some of that, you know, that discussion of how he went about making the decision to get back going again. So Fraser Mulholland is going to join us and tell us all about the Vancouver Golf Tour. This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons. With an improved speed bridge and echo damping system for better sound and forge-like feel, TaylorMade went further than even they thought possible to create a distance iron that feels better than anyone thought possible. Think about it. How many distance irons can say they have their own sound engineer? In fact, they sound and feel so good, some of the TaylorMade pros thought the irons were forged. The all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons, designed for distance you can feel. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. All right, we want to welcome to the Tee Talk podcast, Fraser Mulholland, the president and commissioner of the Vancouver Golf Tour. Welcome to the show.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a great day out here over in North Vancouver.
So for you, you know, a lot of people are maybe not familiar on this end of the country with the Vancouver Golf Tour. Why don't you give people a little synopsis of what the tour is all about, how it got started?
Absolutely. Yeah, we kicked the tour off in 2006, so 14 years ago. It was sort of born out of, you know, the vision I had as a past player and somebody who had, you know, glimpses of success playing some tournament golf, but also struggled by spending far too much money, you know, across the globe. And ultimately, you know, after, you know, 8 to 10 years of, you know, spending too much money and not making enough, I packed it in, but I wanted to make sure that the local players had something more than just a few events to play in and a preparation tool for them to come from college golf and play local professional golf before they hit the Mackenzie Tour, or what was back then the Canadian Tour. And, you know, 14 years later, we've grown from, you know, year one was one event where we sent the winner, Bryn Perry, down to Q School. And that was always our goal, was to send the winner of our season down there on a paid entry down there to see if we would try and groom that person to get down and become a PGA Tour player when the Q School was for the PGA Tour. Bryn Perry. Went all the way down in the first year, went all the way down in the final stage, the final round. He bogeyed his last hole, but the story was set that if you pay for someone to get down there, there's an opportunity. And we've continued to do that for the last 14 years. And, you know, as you well know, that two of our, you know, brightest stars that are shining the VGT flag, Nick Taylor and Adam Hadwin, both PGA Tour players and PGA Tour winners. The story is there that we are trying to do our best to give these young players a chance to play, learn, and learn to win before they reach the PGA Tour.
So what was the evolution for the tour? You said, you know, you had one event, but, you know, and Bryn obviously is, you know, proved to be a, you know, a flagship player for you. But how quickly did that evolve into multiple events?
Well, year two, 2000, and trust me, 2006 was a full year of working on that event. It was a big task that we undertook. We tried to put on a big purse for those pros out at Northview, a $20,000 pro-am. And after that event, we said, well, let's launch a season. Let's start with maybe a dozen events. I think that's what we had in our first season was 12 events. We created some of our new. We talked to golf course owners and operators and head pros and said, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put a season down, add to some of the existing tournaments that are already on the schedule for some of the club pros and put it together in a season. We managed to we wrote a few letters to some sponsors, IGA, Stores of British Columbia. They've been our flagship sponsor for 14 years through a personal friend of mine who was one of their VPs in my days when I actually did some volunteer work for the Greater Vancouver. It was at the time the Greater Vancouver Open, which turned into the Air Canada Championship. So through my, you know, networking there and he was on the steering committee. He adopted the VGT as one of their community sponsorship programs, and all of a sudden we had a title sponsor of the tour. And so with that, we had some prize money that we could put in for some of the events and a purse at the end for the winner to take and take down a PGA Tour school. And so, yeah, the first season had about 12 events and slowly but surely each year we kind of added on one or two more, made another partnership with a couple of existing events on the calendar. You know, and 14 years later, we've evolved into a, you know, a 32 tournament season through the spring and summer. And then we have also a winter season, different league that we do, which is definitely much smaller, but it keeps guys sharp that maybe can't afford to get down and play in Phoenix or Arizona or in Palm Springs. And we have another 20 events. So we have over 50 events a year now that we are running. And it's basically every week, one or two events a week. And they range from single day events with pros and amateurs in it, pro-ams, all the way up to our biggest championship of the year is our 3-day 54 hole Vancouver Open Championship that has a charity pro-am on the Wednesday as well. So it's come a long way. It's definitely not where I see it ending. You know, whenever that day is, when I retire, I want it to continue to grow and continue to give professionals and young amateurs and juniors that opportunity to really learn and give themselves the best affordable opportunity to make their way from local tournament golf onto the Mackenzie Tour, a Korn Ferry Tour and beyond.
You're also a PGA of Canada member, tour commissioner, banana and water bottle filler, you know, at the tournaments. Like, how do you do it all? Because, like, running a golf tournament for one day is not easy, and it sounds like that's not your only gig.
No, I have, I carry a few hats. Yeah, and the hats change on an hourly basis sometimes from, you know, on the day, it could be starter, setup guy, to starter, to, you know, communications with the rules team, to takedown guy, to running water, bananas. We pitch, you know, and we're lucky to have such a great team of volunteers and core team, but sometimes it just comes to the core group of people who are there. With running so many events, it truly is a lot to try and get. You know, honestly, we need a dozen to 20 volunteers per event. You spread that over 30 events, and there's going to be somewhere we're pretty light on the volunteer side. So it's our core team just kind of picking up the pieces and running around basically for, you know, 12 to 14 hours and just getting the job done.
We were talking about bananas as a joke, and I just want your quick thoughts. I saw this tweet today that said the PGA Tour is no longer giving water and snacks to the professionals. How do you think they're going to handle this? Because, you know, I've caddied out there and sometimes they forget their hat, let alone bringing food and water. Or is this just another job for the caddy in your eyes?
Well, it's strange to say that because in previous years, we would do that. We would provide water. We would provide fruit, banana at the turn in many of our events. Luckily, we've got IGA as our sponsor and their, you know, grocery chain that we can, you know, get some gift cards and manage to get that done. This year, we've done the same. And it is just to keep things as safely as possible with, you know, zero touch points from us. If we can eliminate the spread from VGT to our players by handling fruit, banana, waters, and put it on the players to do their own shopping, bring their own snacks. We provide them usually a lunch voucher, or we usually give the kiosk personnel a list of our tee sheet, and they will provide our players with a sandwich and a bottle of water. So in a way, and that's their choice. If they don't feel safe enough to handle something that another staff member of the golf course has, then that's up to them. And that's in a notice that they don't have to take it. They can bring their own things. And on the, as we get into the mid part of summer, as we get into some really hot weather here, especially in Chilliwack in the Valley, where it gets up to mid 30s for a couple of our events, we may have to rethink that, you know, the bottle of water and just make it, extremely careful and have someone handing it out, you know, wiping the bottles down. It's going to be a lot of work, but when it gets to 30, 35 degrees, I don't think any pro is going to carry half a dozen bottles of water and some Gatorade in their bag. And they, you all need that out there when you're out there for 4 or 5
Sounds
hours.
Miserable from a caddy's perspective. That's what the first thing I thought about when I saw the water. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. So quickly, I don't want to get into it too much, but I know obviously for you, you know, we're talking a little bit about the, you know, the health situation that's happening right now. You guys had a pause in your season. You weren't actually sort of restarting, but you know, you were basically the first professional tour to kick things off for this year. And I know from being in some, you know, winter Zoom chats with you, you know, you were having a hard time making some decisions, but you know, how difficult was that for you to, you know, get the tour started again, given that we were, you know, mid pandemic still?
Well, it has been, challenging, to say the least. And, it not just from a scheduling point of view, but mentally, where we were on lockdown for a few weeks thinking this could be possibly the end of the tour. This could be, you know, 14 years worth of a lot of work from a lot of people. And it honestly, for weeks upon end, we were really, truly every day watching the announcements on TV as to where this thing was going in BC, in Canada, the rest of the world, and hoping, crossing our fingers that this was not, we were not going to be the next outbreak. And thank goodness, I just think it was a bit of luck. You know, BC's spring break was a little bit later than the rest of Canada and other places. And so we managed as a province to stop people from going down on the spring break and give them the warnings they needed to stay at home. And so less people had to come back and maybe bring it from higher populated areas where maybe there was more outbreaks. And BC got very lucky. And so we got lucky because of it. And then since then, since we, you know, the health authorities, we're clear that golf at the time being in the kind of mid part of April was allowed to be open. There was no real notice from the health authorities that golf had to shut down, but there were some strong messages to stay at home and to stay in your own community. If you absolutely had to get out and shop and do that, but then otherwise please try and stay at home. And then, you know, as the weeks went on, as golf, a few of the golf owners and golf courses decided to stay open, spread out their tee time intervals, do the things that were required. When Dr. Bonnie here in BC said, these are the things you need to do if you're going to keep your business open. And if you can manage to keep it where there's social distancing and where there's no gathering of any sorts, then you can stay open. If you can't, if you're a restaurant and it's going to be bringing people inside in closed spaces, you're not going to be able to do it that way. You're going to have to do takeout only. So that's what some of the owners, they smartly and bravely kept their businesses open and with no problems. You know, obviously it was a lot of work, a lot of signage, a lot of, you know, sanitation areas and a lot of things changed. And the intervals changed. So for the golfers that were out there, very safe, very spread out, only arriving to the golf course maybe 10 to 20 minutes before their tee times. And what we heard was, this is manageable. We can do this. And it actually seems really quiet. We're busy, but they're so spread out that this is great. I mean, if we could run our golf businesses like this, and it wouldn't seem so chaotic when everyone's in the shop and punching the till all day, this could work. And so we kind of took that mentally, that we can probably do it too. And it did take, a phone call to the health authorities myself to reassure myself that we weren't just going out and doing it without getting consent and permission, because there was certainly a stigma out there as far as you can't gather if you're bringing a group together, 50 people or more. And that was definitely a worry that, wow, we are an event organizer. And it does kind of say that organizers you can't bring groups together 50 or more. Man, maybe we're in trouble. So I made the phone call. I held my breath because I didn't know what the answer was going to be. And I explained, minute by minute, how we would come into the facility, how we would operate our tournaments, stagger the tee times, allow the players only, 20 to 30 minutes before their time, make sure that it's very spaced out, that there would be very few people on the putting green and the driving range at the time. We would work with the golf courses and their COVID rules. And the golfers, even if we were over 50, 100, we might be 120. They're going to be so spread out over 150 acres. Are we considered by doing this? Are we lumped into this mass gatherings category? And the answer was no. And that was, I'm emotional right now.
Yeah.
Because it was, if it was yes, that would have been crushing.
Well, yeah, it's your business that you worked on for the last 14 years, right? And, a lot of small businesses can't make it through this. And, you see that every single day. It's unfortunate. And we were lucky to have a couple on over the last couple of weeks that have found ways to make it through this. And if we bring it back to, the golfers out there, they're really small businesses themselves, right? They're out there, and can they make it through this? Can their pro career continue through this? Considering a lot of people, that do the play professional golf, they have these kind of side hustles, and that's all it is, just to make them enough money to get out there. If they can't even go to work, how are they even going to get back out there? Fortunate for some of your big names out there, these guys out on the PGA Tour like Nick Taylor, who doesn't need to hold on to a second job and is able to make it out there. He was able to still compete, even though he wasn't in the United States, and was able to come out and play your golf tour for the first time in a few years, that's safe to say, and kind of find that competitive itch again right up till the last couple holes this last weekend.
Yeah, well, what an amazing experience for, there's so many players. Both, we had him out for a one-day event back, a couple weeks ago out in Chilliwack at Cultus Lake. That was a fantastic experience. The media was out there. A lot of young kids that were playing in it. A 16-year-old junior beat him on the day. That was a great story alone. And then he decided that, yeah, he had some time. And obviously, with not going down back to the PGA Tour until, another 10 days or so, why not? And, I think it's also, he wanted to support the tour, and he realizes his impact by coming to play an event of ours is so, so huge, that that was part of it too, that he wanted to support the tour. And boy, it was quite an event. 132 players in the field, 96 that went on to play day two. And you could not have asked for a better final round, with Nick in the final group shooting 67 the first day. Mike Bell, a local player from Vancouver Golf Club, and then another SFU alumni playing with them, John McClotick from Kelowna, BC, shooting 65 on day one. And it was, it was a great battle. First of all, it was, Nick setting the way on the front nine. He had it going just so smoothly, 4 under par, not making really an error in sight. John really struggling, shot 1 over, and that's arguably fairly easy nine where the guys can post a 3, 4, 5 under par. Evan Holmes shot 6 under. He had charged up the board. Mike was, 3 or 4 under. At one point, there were maybe 6 or 7 guys that were within, 2 shots of Nick, and it was going to be a fun back nine. But ultimately, John just kind of kept clawing away, and he kept just chewing away, making birdies. And Nick, you know, made a few birdies of his own on the back, but just not enough. John reeled him in, made an eagle on 13, made another birdie on 15. Nick, you know, was hitting decent shots, just not making his putts. And then all of a sudden, it was a one-shot cushion with three to go. And John almost birdied his last five holes, basically. He missed about a 10-footer on 16. He hit it to 2 feet on about 180-yard par three, tapped in for his birdie. They went down 18, all even. And Nick had to kind of hit a nice punch shot under the trees, hit a great shot to about 30 feet. And we thought, oh, you know, maybe Nick's not just, he's not going to let him win. John hits it to about 12 feet under the hole. Nick's putt, I mean, it lipped out and it all looked like it was in. And you thought, yep, no, he's not going to let this guy in. And he missed it, but John stepped up confidently and got the job done to win by one shot. And, you know, the things that I take from that are, you know, what an experience for all the players to that can measure themselves against a player that's been having a great season this year. Just won on Pebble Beach, the AT&T Pebble Beach champion, took down Lefty in dramatic fashion. And for all the players that can say they kept within one or two shots of Nick Taylor on those 2 days, and for John to take him down playing in the final group, I mean, he's going to have some great memories of that day.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess, one of the big things of this tour. And I think that's what, you know, Adam Hadwin, Nick Taylor, they all recognize what support this provides, especially for players from British Columbia and, you know, a feeder for, you know, their other opportunities around the world. I mean, Chris Chrysalago is another, you know, young player that's coming up. But, you know, on the female side as well, Christine Wong shooting 65, you know, to finish on the final round. You've had some amazing players. But, you know, where do you see your role as a tour for all these amateurs and the club pros and the touring pros? I mean, there's obviously a point of pride for you to see them go on and have success, but do you feel now that you're integral to the development system for golf in British Columbia?
I do. I think we are. And I think we have been for a number of years. And, you know, just the fact that there have been so many that have used us early in the season, I think that's probably the biggest piece that we offer for young players who are starting their young professional career. And they can utilize us in the spring. They can get ready, get tournament tough before they hit the Q school, which is usually in, you know, kind of early May. And we would have maybe 7 or 8 events that they can play in BC while the weather's still decent enough and get themselves really sharp and prepare for that Q school. And then a few weeks later, we fit in another 2 or 3 events conveniently for them right before the first event on the Mackenzie Tour in early June. And again, it's just more preparation, more reps, more opportunity to hold those putts down the stretch in preparation to take on the Mackenzie Tour and whatever tour they're aiming for. And, you know, a classic example of that would be last year with James Allenby, where James had no status on the Mackenzie Tour in 2019 at the beginning of the year, through some amazing and impressive play on our tour early in the season. The Canada Life Open organizers gave James an invitation just from all the send outs we were sending and saying, man, this guy, you got to let this guy in. He's 64 under for 8 rounds in tournament play. He's 8 under a day. How can you not have this guy in? So they gave James a spot to, you know, with a couple weeks to go, and James almost won that tournament. And James rode that invitation or exemption into the Mackenzie event onto a really good season, a top 20 finish on the order of merit. And, you know, he was top Canadian, I think, at least that one and maybe one more time. And, you know, that really sprung his career last year. It's a shame that he's not getting to, you know, to prove himself again out there on the Mackenzie Tour, because he was chomping at the bit and ready to go. And I think that's what our tour does. It just serves for the young players. It gives them an opportunity to mentor if they're young juniors. We have a ton of juniors this year. It's just been amazing to see the talent from 11 and 12 year olds all the way up to, you know, 18 year olds, because a lot of the zone juniors are not running and the Maple Leaf Tour is only starting this weekend. So for the first 2 months, they joined BGT and played almost every event. And for them to kind of get into the mix with these top amateurs that are older and stronger and top professionals in our region, what a great experience. And I think that's going to come. We're going to see more of them to come for sure.
So, you know, you're 50 events in now, or 50 events per year, I guess, 14 years into the tour. Where's this all headed?
Well, honestly, I would love to think that we at some point can bridge a partnership between the Vancouver Golf Tour and the McKenzie Tour. That would be my ultimate goal, is that the top player or players from our tour is graduating onto the McKenzie Tour. And that is ultimately my goal, is to give the VGT and the players that play in our region, in our province, and potentially into other provinces if we do expand, an opportunity to launch from our tour onto the McKenzie Tour, and eventually from there onto the Korn Ferry and beyond. And, you know, ultimately it's continuing to drive the purses higher and continue to find more sponsors and more partners and more education for these young pros. I think there's way more we can do to give these young guys and girls an opportunity to have the tools in place through playing our tour to get beyond our tour and onto some major, major tours.
Well, we want to thank you. You've done an amazing job. It's certainly been quite a story for the last 14 years. And I know a lot of players are very thankful as well that you put in the effort to make this happen. And I think you've made the dreams happen for them, much like it would have been for you. I mean, you obviously would have liked this to be in place when you were coming up. And thanks for coming on Tee Talk. We look forward to getting updates on the tour and following you throughout the season.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Fraser, for that interview. We're happy to hear that the Vancouver Golf Tour is still up and running. And I see, you know, guys like Nick Taylor out there supporting it. You know, he got a start out on that tour, you know, playing McKenzie Tour, coming back, won about five times out on that tour. So it's cool that he's still out there just being competitive while spending time with his family. And, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, the goal that Fraser set originally starting it is still happening.
Yeah, he's done a great job with it, has a lot of loyalty from the players and, you know, from the pros, the amateurs, everybody. So it's just nice to see something organic that way. And, you know, it really fills a void for a lot of golfers on the West Coast.
For sure. Well, let's talk about what's happening this week. Unfortunately, the LPGA is still no longer playing. And don't worry, we will get back to talking about the LPGA once it comes back.
Can't wait to eventually. Yeah,
yeah, we're big fans of the LPGA and ladies golf, but we just haven't had a chance to talk about it because there's nothing really going on. So why don't we talk about what is going on? And we have the Travelers Championship, and they're up near Hartford there and Cromwell, Connecticut. So third consecutive week that they're back playing. What are your thoughts about the Travelers? Does this bring you any joy? What do you know about this golf course?
I mean, it's another TPC course, so it's not all that exciting. I mean, there's a lot of heritage to this event, going back to, you know, Hartford Open days and stuff like that. It's probably got a little bit more cachet now, just this year, because you got the top five players in the world are in the field. You've certainly got a quality field that way. So you probably I'll probably pay a little bit more attention to it, but otherwise it's not one that really excites me too much, you know, unlike maybe the Heritage, where you watch Harbortown, and as you mentioned earlier in the show, you know, there's a lot of cool shots, a lot of things that you have to do. This is just a straight out TPC event. And, you know, while there's some, you know, gambler type holes, drivable par fours and stuff like that, maybe not all that exciting. There's been some cool moments over the years, Spieth holding that bunker shot. Yeah, just the fact that the top players are back again will probably make it pretty decent to watch.
For sure. I think maybe, I don't know when we'll actually start having this conversation, but you're seeing guys play for 3 weeks in a row, which is pretty rare on the tour nowadays for the top players, right? I do wonder, at what point are we going to see guys like Brooks and Rory and Phil? Phil's 50, and he's playing 3 weeks in a row, right? Like, it's, you know, I wonder how many more they'll go, or if they're just expecting to just keep on playing because they don't want to get out of the bubble.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of them will, you know, do some big runs, like you're saying. They don't want to get out of the bubble, so they're playing more weeks in a row. But at some point, they're going to get tired and want to have a rest, even though they've been off for a while. It still is probably a more stressful environment than it normally is, just, again, with all the testing and everything that's going on. So I would say that, you know, there might be a few of them that will kind of, you know, pull the chute a little bit earlier than maybe they thought they would. But, yeah, Phil in the field here, I mean, Phil won this two times, but it's almost 20 years ago since he won this event. That's crazy. So that's pretty remarkable when we think about it. He won it twice in 2001, 2002. Whether he's going to be competitive with Bryson and Rory, who he's paired with in the first 2 days, I don't know, but it's probably going to be worth some camera time, no doubt.
Yeah, he's I'm starting to lose some trust in Phil. Well, I was just really adamant that I really thought he'd win another Masters and stuff, and I'm just not seeing much from him right now, and maybe the age is starting to catch up to him, which, you know, wasn't the case last week with Bernhard Langer. You know, he made the cut at, what is he, 60?
Age 62, yeah.
Yeah, so that's impressive, but... You know, I wonder if Phil will get it back. I hope to see him get it back here and get in contention again because he gets exciting. But there's kind of four feature groups this week, and I'm going to just quickly wonder which one you want to watch the most. So you got Bryson, Rory, and Phil as one, Brooks, Xander, and Justin Thomas as another, John Rahm, Ches Reavy, and Webb Simpson as another, and then Dustin Johnson, Colin Morikawa, and Jordan Spieth. So if you only could watch one of these, which one are you picking?
I would probably lean towards the DeChambeau, McIlroy, Mickelson one by, you know, just saying, you know, they'll probably be the more spectacular, but I'm probably more curious about the DJ Morikawa Spieth one, more for Morikawa and Spieth. I mean, I'm still waiting to see Spieth sort of bust out here. Morikawa bust out here. Spieth obviously had a win here 3 years ago when he held that bunker shot. But I definitely I'm more curious about the players that are on the rise rather than the ones that are maybe longer in their career.
That's fair. I'm thinking for me, because if we're talking feature groups, that means on Golf TV, they're going to have every single shot that you can watch for them. And with that means you're going to get a lot of audio content. So I'm going John Rahm, Ches Reavy, and Webb Simpson. Now, Do we have two people in this group that are more polar opposites than John Rahm and Webb Simpson? Like, John Rahm might get fined, you know, 10 times in the first round. And Webb Simpson's just, you're good. You're a Christian boy, aw shucks, you know, family man. Yeah. And then Ches Reavy, I think, is just underrated, great golf swing that we just never get to see out on the tour. That's the one I want to watch, so I'll be watching that on Thursday and Friday for sure.
And hey, you know what? Ches is the defending champion. We got to give him his props. You know what
exactly.
I mean? So he's probably the player that people didn't really expect. And, you know, a former RBC Canadian Open winner as well. He's a great guy. He really is. I mean, he won that RBC Canadian Open and he showed up at a Golf Journalists Association of Canada event the very next day because he had committed to the sponsor of being there. So not RBC. It was a clothing sponsor he had at the time. So great dude. And that would be interesting just to see. Maybe it'll be good for Rahm. Maybe it'll be a little bit calmer with those two around. Maybe he goes to explode once or twice and then looks over and, you know, maybe sees Webb over there throwing holy water on him or something. And maybe he stays a little bit calmer. Who knows? We'll see.
We will find out, I guess. Every week lately, you've been bringing some games to the table. So this week I'm bringing a game to the table. I don't think we've played Would You Rather before. So we're going to play a little game of Would You Rather, and I'm going to give Scott some scenarios. I'm going to answer them too, but sure. I'm going to come up with some scenarios. You got to pick one or the other, and we'd love to hear people playing along at home. Feel free to tweet us or follow us on Instagram and DM us and let us know your thoughts or why we picked the worst one of the two here. So Scott, are you ready for a game of golf's Would You Rather?
I think I am. Let's go. Let's do it.
All right, so our first would you rather is, would you rather hole out from the fairway twice per year for eagle or better for the rest of your life, or would you rather get a hole in one within the next year, but you never get another eagle or better for the rest of your life?
Oh, you can have the hole in ones. I'll take the eagles all the time. The hole outs, I'm good with that. I mean, I had one hole in one, so I guess that's okay. But I don't always look at that as the holy grail. It's exciting and everything, but for the fact that I'd have to have that hole in one wouldn't make another eagle or better for the rest of my life. I'll take the front end of that one.
Yeah, I agree on this one. I think it's easier for us to say, as we've both had one. I've had two, not a big deal. Yeah, you want to make some eagles. If I'm getting two a year in hole outs, like it did, yeah. It's also eagle or better, right? If I'm getting two a year, who knows? There could be an albatross in there. I guess I'd have to hit a par five.
And a hole in one is just an eagle anyway. So, I mean, yeah,
that one's right. Easy. If somebody else out there is like, no, you're wrong. Let's hear it. All right. Our next one. Okay. Would you rather, now we're going down a different road, less positive. Would you rather once around have a shank would you rather once around every single round you play, you get one shank, or every single round you three putt five holes. So that's every round forever. You either shank it just once, one shank, everything else is normal. Yeah. Or every round you three putt five holes.
Oh, I'll take the shank every day. Three putts on five holes per round would put me in the poorhouse because I would be snapping putters left, right, and sideways. I would be so frustrated. You know, the randomness of a shank, you know, when it pops up, it's terrifying. What's especially terrifying is the next shot, wondering if you're going to shank again. But you know what? It's done. It's over. In this scenario, I know it's over. You know, once around, it's done. But, you know, obviously three putts, five holes per round. Oh, that would just be pure anguish.
Yeah, I think the three putts is tough. The shank gets to you, though. And it's like,
they're both really tough mentally. That's for sure.
Every shot, like I'm just standing over it for, you know, I had a shank on the weekend and then I went out and played yesterday in the blistering heat and I actually had another one and now I'm a little worried. So I guess I'm going to go with it. If it's just one around, whatever, you know, you're taking double, but if you're three putting five holes, what if it's the ones that you're supposed to be getting up and down for par, right? Like if you're saving bogeys, turning five doubles out there, you never know. Right. So I think it's the shank.
Mentally not good either.
Neither suck. Well, let's go into a different route. Okay, so would you rather play one golf course for the rest of your life? You get to choose any golf course. Imagine it's in your backyard. You can play it the rest of your life, but that's the only golf course you ever get to play. Or every time you golf, it's a new golf course you've never played before, so you can't go back to a previous one.
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, yeah, I had a quick look at this in our notes and trying to waffle here on this. Let's go new course that I've never played. I like playing lots of different golf courses. I've been lucky to play a lot of golf courses in my life. Unfamiliar or not, I don't mind the surprises. So I'm going to go with that experience.
I'm actually going the opposite with you on this.
Really?
I find personally, I need to play a course a couple times to appreciate the surroundings and love it and not be worried about the score. And like, maybe it's just me, but like I find, you know, I think I would struggle going out to like Pebble Beach only once and just like, I would need to just kind of keep myself in the moment, be like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Just like look or like, I'd want to play seven, three, four, five times. And
so you're the guy who gets done on 18 and go, man, I want another shot at that because there's seven holes that I would have played way differently. Right?
Yeah. I just want to go back out. And I think we're both members at golf courses. You just bought a membership again, which welcome back Thank to you. Actually playing golf. Don't top it on one. I think, you know, I don't really ever get bored of playing my golf course. I find ways to play it differently. There's so many different sets of tees and now I'm getting to pick any one. So like, what if it is Pebble Beach or something along those lines or, you know, like Augusta, I don't know if that's actually it, but like something along those lines, I'm going Spyglass. Who knows? Right. Like I'm just, I'm going with a super nice one. It's in my backyard. I get to play it as much as I want. That's fine with me.
Yeah, if it's in my backyard, I think that's an easy one. I'd love to follow my door onto a golf course, that's for sure. But yeah, anyways.
All right, this next one, we're going down a different road. We got three more. Would you rather win every club championship you play in for the rest of your life? So, you know, you're at the club, any club you get to join, you're winning every club championship. Or you find a stroke of magic. You have this 1 6-month stretch where, you know, you turn it to be the best golfer in the world and you get one chance at the PGA Tour. You play one event on the PGA Tour, only one event, and then you that was the only status you got. Say you missed the cut, you never win anything ever again, but you made it to the PGA Tour based on true merit and play. What do you pick? The unlimited club championships for the rest of your life, or that one event on the PGA Tour that you actually earned and got yourself there?
Yeah, I think for me, it's a game of a lifetime. So I'm going to take the front end of that one with the club championships. While it's would be cool to obviously, you know, play so well that you get onto the PGA Tour and you get to play an event, it might hold more mystique for me, I guess, if I wasn't out covering that over the years and stuff, and then see that sometimes it's maybe not all that it's cracked up to be. And then really from an ego side of it, that's fine. I don't need to get to the PGA Tour. I'd be happy winning those club championships if I was a club level player.
Yeah. So I'm picking that as well, but not even, I have zero care about actually winning the club championships. Is that I couldn't take the fact that
you'd never win anything else.
That not even that, just I've never won anything anyway, but the fact that there'd be documentaries about me, stories, every few years, somebody would go searching for you. What happened to Stefan? Right. That talent out of nowhere.
You'd be the next guy on Losers, that Netflix thing that we talked about a few weeks ago.
All that way up there. And then, you wouldn't give up because you're not told this is what happens, right? You're just, this is what happens. And now you're putting all the money into finding that stretch again, and you're just grinding it out, even trying to get onto the Corn Ferry Tour or wherever. And then nothing happens. I couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. I'm not built for the heartbreak of that. So I'm taking the first one. Probably wouldn't good even reason. Matter to me, but it's just because I couldn't handle the second one.
All right. That's a fun one.
All right. We got two more here. All right. This one is another kind of one similar to not the last one, but the one before about the golf courses. So you get to choose three playing partners and be assigned to play 36 holes in one day on a completely random golf course. So you're picking your playing partners, but you got to go out, play 36 wherever they choose the golf course, or the opposite. You go play 36, you get to pick the golf course, but your random pickings on the pairing.
Ooh, you know what? We've said it before on this podcast, and I truly believe it. It's about the experience of the people that you play with. So, I think as much as I love playing randomly with people that I've never met before, being able to choose my three playing partners and then just take it on whatever golf course, I know I'm guaranteed to have a good time. Doesn't matter, if it's a terrible golf course or a great golf course, whatever it is, I'm going to have a good experience with three people that I enjoy playing golf with and spending time with.
I agree. And again, it's less about, I think it's, your 36 holes is 10 plus hours of your day.
Yeah, that's a long time.
It's a long time.
You're with.
Now imagine you're like, well, I'm going to go play Augusta National. Now imagine you get there and maybe these are your people. But imagine Trump and Patrick Reed and Vijay Singh or something are your group. Or yeah. I don't know, somebody awful, right? That might not be the most fun thing. And now you're stuck there for 10 hours. And you want to enjoy this place because you're probably only ever playing it once. And you're having to deal with Patrick Reed go on about whatever and Trump make up lies and have Secret Service dropping balls and the whole, it would just be a disaster. So I agree with you on the first one there.
That's awesome.
All right. Last one for you. This, we've talked a lot about how we don't care what people wear on golf courses and we need to loosen this up. Last night when I actually went out to play my three holes, it was late at night. I wore my t-shirt and some skate shoes and
awesome.
Nobody said anything. So I sweat right through it, but here's it got me thinking. So here's your two options. An entire year, would you rather have to play every single round for that year barefoot, or you have to play every single round for that year in only a basketball jersey and army cargo shorts that go to your mid shin? So that is that's a very important part. They're cargo shorts, they're army color, and they go right to the middle of your shin.
I think neither would bother me, but if I had a preference, even though I'm 50, and then maybe the basketball jersey and army cargo shirts might get me chirped a little bit, my daughter, but I'll go barefoot. I'll go Sam Snead style, backwoods of Virginia. I've hit golf balls in bare feet before on the range. I don't mind walking in the grass as long as the geese are not around like at your golf course. But I will go barefoot over the jersey and the cargo shorts. How's that? What about you?
Here's the issue, though, Scott. You got it. They're both... They're both bad because when you're going barefoot, right, you can you get anything else, right? Say it's raining, whatever, you get your rain gear, but your, you know, your extremities are what make you cold. Now you're putting your feet in who knows what, like geese crap. That could be one of the options. And then the opposite, right? Like we're in Canada. You know, when we want to play the spring, it could be 10 degrees. Now you're out there in basketball jerseys. At least your legs are going to be warm because you're wearing capris out there. But I'm strong. This is the hardest.
That's a tough one.
That's
a 50-50 almost.
I wouldn't play well wearing those pants. I know I couldn't look at myself and have these cargo shorts. Like I couldn't play well. It doesn't matter what shoes I'm wearing. So I guess I gotta go barefoot. I don't love it. I know, like, think about how disgusting your feet would be. Like, you wouldn't even be allowed in your home after the round. Like, your wife already hates you when you've gone for a 5-hour round and then you're trying to take a nap on a Sunday with golf on TV. Now your feet, who knows?
See, but, you know what? You had to grow up in the 1970s when we were barefoot all the time, and then maybe it wouldn't bother you as much. So.
Yeah, you hippies back then. There you go. We'd love to hear your answers. Make sure you reach out to us on Twitter, Instagram, and let us know what you think, or if you have any other would you rathers. I think maybe next week or a week in the future, maybe we'll do a mailbag and that's it, just would you rather questions, because this was fun. Speaking of mailbag, we're gonna grab a quick break and then we're gonna hit the mailbag and then a tip of the week from the coach, Scotty McLeod.
This episode of T-Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons. With an improved speed bridge and echo damping system for better sound and forge-like feel, TaylorMade went further than even they thought possible to create a distance iron that feels better than anyone thought possible. Think about it. How many distance irons can say they have their own sound engineer? In fact, they sound and feel so good, some of the TaylorMade pros thought the irons were forged. The all-new SimMax and SimMax OS irons, designed for distance you can feel. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. We already thanked him, right? We already did that?
Yeah.
I'm blanking out.
Yeah.
All right, we're on to the mailbag now, the popular segment. A lot of people send in their questions very quickly this week, which was great. Certainly getting a lot of variety of questions here. We certainly appreciate it. Keep sending them in, and we'll keep answering them. So let's start with the first one here. What is the most unique, memorable golf hole you have ever played? Stefan, you want to tackle that one?
This is weird. Are we talking about our own, like just like how we played on it, or the actual hole itself? Because there's two different directions to take. Do you think the actual hole itself is where we want to go? What are your thoughts?
I think so. It's the actual hole itself. I think from an architecture standpoint, rather than us, you know, making a 17 on a par 3 or something.
See, I don't know if I really have one that's standing out, just because you know, I haven't really played anything crazy. I got nothing. I mean, I stood on the bridge at 18 of St. Andrews, but wasn't holding a golf club. So I guess that's my one that I'll always remember, and hopefully one day I get to play it. But I really don't have one that like sticks out of my mind. I guess like the one, you know, I'll pick one. This isn't the best golf course, but the 18th hole on the golf course in Cuba. If you haven't played that golf course,
Veradero.
Yeah, it's an interesting track, some weird holes, but the 18th hole is great, right along the ocean. Great tee shot with the ocean behind you, and you know, you go up to the green a bit, and you're seeing the ocean. It's just a beauty way to finish your round with the clubhouse in behind. So, I guess I'll go with that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of them that stand out for a lot of different reasons, whether they're, you know, they're tough or, you know, they're just very dramatic. You mentioned St. Andrews there, just up the road at Kings Barnes. There's a couple of spectacular holes there that go along the ocean that I think would stand out. I believe it's the 12th, which is a par 5 that is unbelievable there along the ocean. You know, in North America, yeah, I guess if I wanted to look at one in particular, That's a really tough one. I would say probably some of the holes at Tobacco Road, down in near Pinehurst area. There's a par five there that doglegs right around a corner and has two massive mounds that totally blind you on the approach into the green. And it's really fairly unique as far as playing it. But, I'm the same as you. I don't really think about, certain holes all the time standing out. I just like the feel of a property overall rather than just a particular hole. All right, let's move on to another one here. If you could only attend one LPGA event, which one would it be?
They're all really great in terms of, like, you're going to get way close to the fans. Let's go with a U.S. Open, just in the sense of they set it up just as difficult for the women as they do the men. But the women tend to navigate a golf course a little bit differently, thinking a little bit more. They don't have the bombing ability, a lot of them, to bomb over a lot of the trouble. So I think it'd just be a way cooler experience to watch them navigate that. I think one of my favorite events ever watching was when Michelle won that, the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, and just watching her navigate around that. And that was just a great tournament. Any LPGA event's going to be great, but yeah, give me the U.S. Open. I think that'd be it's just going to be different to see how they handle super long rough and things along those lines.
Yeah, I think I'd, for almost the exact same reasons, I think I'd probably want to see the Women's British Open just again to see how the players tackled that type of design, if they're going to take on a links design and how they would go about playing it, maybe, whatever destination that could be. They play a lot of great ones there, but, I would like to see how an LPGA player takes on some of those links golf courses, generally because, they're very talented and there might be a lot of players that have talents in certain areas that maybe PGA Tour players don't and have to play it certain ways. So I would go the Women's British Open.
And I also think the reason that U.S. Open stood out to me is because they both played the same course. And
that's true. Yeah.
I think they should do that every year. Wouldn't that be so much cooler if, like, the Open, the British Open, whatever you want to call it, was at St. Andrews, and then 2 weeks later, they got it back into shape, and now we have the ladies out there. That'd be way cooler than, they knew it there, and now the ladies are at, where was that awful course they played last year for the British Open? It was like a course out of, Carolinas. It was horrible. It was not a good golf course for a British Open, if I'm remembering it correct. Regardless. I just want to see the same test and just see how they both navigate the same course, just differently.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's move on to another one here. Back to Webb Simpson, who obviously won this past week at the RBC Heritage. Someone is asking, by the time Webb Simpson is retired from the PGA Tour, how many wins do you think he will have, and will he be in the Golf Hall of Fame?
The Golf Hall of Fame is an interesting question. I think if he gets, say, 3 more, then we might have a pretty good case here. You got 9 in a major, right? That's kind of a good case. That being said, and a lot of Ryder Cups, I guess that helps.
Yeah.
That being said, I don't know. Like, these questions are hard. Webb could disappear again. It doesn't look like he's been a man of consistency. He could come out, win one a year. I think the Hall of Fame's a stretch, but I'm going to give him 3-4 more wins, and maybe he's one of those ones that are just on the fringe of the Hall of Fame, but just ultimately don't get in.
Yeah, I think Max, I think he might get 15 wins.
15 and changes things, though.
Yeah, but I think he would still need a second major or a championship, on that resume as well. I think he needs another big, big event if he's going to make it that way. Otherwise, I think the bar is, for most players, is probably closer to 20 wins, and at least one major or two as far as Hall of Fame level.
What about DJ, for just in a different sense? Like, he's at 20 and it's a rare club, but just one major. Is he in the Hall of Fame?
He needs another major, I think. So I think you need multiple majors to really get yourself in there for that. So Webb, 2008, I guess he came on the PGA Tour. So you're in 12, 13. He's only got 7 wins. So he's going to have to step on the gas if he's going to get that up to 15, like I mentioned. My bet would be no. I don't think he gets the Golf Hall of Fame. I think that standard would be a little bit too high. All right, a couple more left here. My 9-year-old wants to play golf with me. How do I choose what tees they should play? That's an interesting one.
Yeah, thoughts? I mean, go to the front at the absolute worst, right? And yeah. then worse than that, like, I'm sure there's a calculation out there that can show how long of a hole he should, you know, he or she should be playing and take them there. And I know US Kids does a lot around that, but maybe you know a little bit more than that.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, I think a lot of people are married to the tee boxes. They're really thinking, you know, they've got to officially be at those spots to play. So I would say, you know, depending on how far the child is able to hit the golf ball, give them an opportunity to get on the green in regulation. So if it's a par four, for an example, you know, depending how far they hit it, if they hit it 100 yards off the tee, you know, and maybe they can, you know, hit another shot in 100 yards from there, let's say, you know, they only need a hole that's a couple hundred yards. You're really trying to breed success. You don't really want defeat. So sometimes that means may mean starting in the fairway. That may mean with little ones starting way forward. You mentioned the U.S. Kids. They have a long leaf system that they're integrated as part of. The U.S. Kids founder had bought this golf course called the Long Leaf Golf Club down in the Carolinas. Came up with an 8-tee system that's based on the yardage the players hit off the tee. And it's a great system. If people want to look it up, do a Google search for long leaf tee system, and you'll see how it works as far as choosing yardages. And you'll find that in most cases, people are playing off yardages that are too far, really going to be defeated. So, don't do that with your 9-year-old. If, you know, especially if you're starting to talk about things like, you know, pars and you know, greens and regulation and stuff like that, you know, if they can't achieve those early on, probably not going to be that much interested in the game. So give them a chance to get on the greens and regulation. You know, nothing better than somebody having a chance to putt for birdie.
You know what I just thought about right now is I think we need to get a petition out there of getting rid of the colors of green, mm-hmm. of tee boxes and literally just have it tee box A, B, C, D, no colors, nothing, or 1, 2, 3, or whatever. And I think that would help so much with this mindset people have of playing a certain tee block because of its color. And, mm-hmm. you know, here on the podcast, I play the blues, right? Wherever. Blues could be in front of the whites. It's a sure. color. It doesn't matter. And I think if we just get rid of this color system and just go to a number system, maybe we'll be in a much better place. And we won't have to worry about things like this. And maybe there is a zero tee block that's out 200 mm-hmm. yards out in front of the fairway. It's just off to the side. That's where they tee off. It's not going to affect the golfers out there anyway. Let's do that. I think different conversation for a different day, but I think the color is actually hurting us more than helping us.
No, that's valid. And there's actually a golf course in Ottawa that actually embarked. I think their longest tees from the back are oranges. So, I mean, they got rid of that system. And within that long length system, they have colors as well. But they're not the traditional colors. And they have some numbering systems that are in there. But I think their first set of tee decks for a player that might only hit it 100 off the tee, I think the golf course setup was like suggested 1800 or 1900 yards. It's really, really close. So golf courses definitely need to be a little bit more progressive and, you know, not put players in a situation where their most forward tees are still 5,000 yards and they can only get on the green in 5. And I think that deters them from having any success and wanting to come back. So I think if this person for their 9-year-old, you know, start close to the green, progressively work their way back and don't worry about where the actual tee blocks are. Create your own tee blocks more than anything. All right, last one here. What's your worst swing thought you always get? Now, I'm really curious for you what this one is going to be for you, if you can define it down to one.
Oh, man, right now it's obviously the shank one.
apparently.
Oh, man, this was a great question. I think it's, for me, there's a couple. Right now it's the driver. I've been talking about that. Like, it's just like, you know, don't hook this, even though my miss has been right. And then, like, I'll hook it because I'm trying not to miss it right. But I think the one that comes up the most is just bunkers. Like, just don't blade it out of the bunker. And I think it's just because I have, like, the bunkers we play in around here are probably just not consistent due to weather and cost alone. My bunker game is just like, you know, don't chunk this.
And the fact there's no rakes out there right now.
Yeah, like, I think it's my bunker one that comes out. But then now I think the shank one's going to hang on for a few weeks until I don't do it again. So I'm going with the shank one, though. If that's in your head, you're done for the day. Yeah. So the shank one.
That's definitely a tough one. For me, it's probably a a left miss. I struggled with that for quite some time. So if I do anything in my game, it's something to fight that miss. And so if I haven't been playing a lot and I really don't trust my swing, that's what I'm afraid of more than anything. I really shouldn't be. I understand kind of how ball flight works. And I would say that's lessened a lot in the last number of years, but it was just kind of a period that I went through where I had a little bit of a left miss, but I've figured that out now. But I've been fortunate. I don't really have a lot of bad swing thoughts. I've been good to keep them out of my brain, and I'm afraid if they get in there, they'll infect it, maybe like yours. How's that?
Yeah, I saw this came from one of my buddies, and I saw a couple comments after saying stuff along the lines of like, don't hit it fat, and then they always hit it fat, drop their shoulder right into the ground. So pretty funny. Luckily I don't have that thought process. I'm just happy to hit it at this point. Well, that's the mailbag for the week, but we can't wrap it up without the tip of the week. So Scotty, let's hear it.
Yeah, well, my tip of the week is not to not hit left. That's not what that's going to be or whatever. I really want to focus on posture more than anything. This is something a lot of people come and see me and they don't really think about it too much. You know, you're doing lessons and things with them and they just sort of grab the club, throw it in their hands and you know, put the club onto the ground and they don't really think of how they're set up and how important it is. You know, your posture really separates how your ability to basically make a good golf swing, make a powerful golf swing, swing the club efficiently and to make a good strike. So it's really important that you really focus on your posture, work with your coach to get a good posture that's really going to help engage your whole body. A lot of people, if they don't have a good posture, they're generally going to swing a lot with their hands and arms. They're going to do some things going to result in poor contact. They're just not going to get as much power as possible. And a real key to all this is how you hinge your hips. And some people have some issues with this from a physical standpoint. So you definitely want to have somebody assess that. What ends up happening is if you can't hinge your hips properly, you end up standing taller, you hunch your shoulders, and then you sort of reach for the ball a lot. And that's not a position that you want to be in. Just leads you down to, you know, a road that you're going to have a lot of bad results from. So work with your coach, have them look at your posture, make sure that you're set up in a good position that will allow a nice dynamic movement in your golf swing. Make sure that you don't have any physical impairments that can keep you from doing that, and you'll be off to a good start in your golf swing.
There you go. I do know that for a fact. We were working with another one of my buddies this week and worked on some posture and foot positioning and where you're getting your weight, and drastic change already. Ended up winning $20 off me. So I will be charging you for that. That's it for this week, folks. We hope you enjoy the Travelers 3 weeks in a row of the PGA Tour. It's nice. Make sure you're watching those feature groups on Thursday and Friday. You can check those out on Golf TV. And I'm sure you'll be able to watch the great coverage on TV with Nick Faldo saying who knows what that adds zero value, but we can't wait for. It's just nice to have sports back. That's simple as it is. But before we go, one last thing. The Flagstick Open is we're still got spots somehow.
Going up quickly though.
There's not many. So make sure you sign up for the Flagstick Open at theflagstickopen.com. You know, we've kind of hinted at the package. You know, what are we getting this year just for sign up? It's $200 just to sign up. And yeah, you walk out the pro shop before you even grabbed your range balls with what?
We've got a pair of Adidas shoes. We've got a TaylorMade backpack. We've got a TaylorMade cap, and we've got a dozen TP5X Picks golf balls as well. So great package for anybody who's playing in the tournament. Basically, you've won before you tee off. So, you know, it's great. Everybody really loves that. And we certainly are happy to work with our sponsors to provide that for our players.
Yeah. So $300 worth of stuff. And you haven't even teed off yet. So there's still your golf included in that. So great package, four different divisions. At this rate, I'll be in the D division. So even if, you know, you're a 14 handicap and you want to come out and play, hey, you get to compete with me. You'll probably beat me because that's how bad I've been playing. But there's a division for all of us, whether you're a scratch plus two, whatever, or you're 14, we'll find a spot for you. And we can't wait for that weekend, August 15th and 16th, out at Equinox Golf Club. Heading there this Friday. So I will report back of how great condition it is in, because it's always in great condition. That's how that course looks. So other than that, we thank you for listening. Make sure you subscribe, rate us 5 stars as per usual, and send in your questions every single week for the mailbag. Or, you know, next week, maybe Would You Rather mailbag. Looking forward to that. On behalf of Scott and I, we thank you for listening. Everyone have a great week. We'll chat soon.